We've got Dr. Tim Joseph, who's a professor from the University of Alberta, and he's also a principal at JPI Mine Equipment. He is going to represent the electric shovel. And we also have John Samet with Komatsu Mining Shovels, and who is also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta, and he is going to advocate on behalf of the hydraulic shovel. And while this brief introduction does not do these two respective pedigrees justice, believe me that we have two of the most respected bananas in the industry going head-to-head in a fact-based live debate, both backed by field measurements and experience on a level playing field. The total energy per ton excavated and weight versus stability arguments find equality of case, the outcome of which may surprise everyone. Sam will defend, promote, while Joseph will represent the electric shovel.
You're going to surprise me.
It's going to surprise me, too.
Yeah, well, you wrote that.
Have you got the clicker?
I have got... No, you. No, I haven't.
What are you arguing about with me? Okay, so let's get... You ready for this? Okay. So in the blue corner, we have to say blue. I can't say yellow, can I?
Cause blue and red.
Blue and red. Red? Where'd the red come from?
Okay.
Weighing in at...
252.
Holy crap. Jesus Christ, John.
Well,
you've got to get out there and get some exercise going
on.
Stop, come on, let's just keep this.
But I'm 6 foot tall. Let's get your stats in a minute.
Well, it's only because you're on the podium.
Come on, get on with it.
So this man is an incredible individual. I'm going to say that up front. He's waiting for the downside here.
I am.
30 years in the industry, both sides of the fence, both as a vendor and as an operator and an end user. That's right, isn't it?
Yes,
that's right. He's also committed himself every year to spend a couple of weeks with me in Alberta helping to educate the next generation, and he's actually been instrumental in actually helping us build that mining school to one of the largest mining schools in the world. So John has actually been doing some really good things in the industry. However, he is the Mongolian king of bananas.
Got a banana fixation.
Well, I know.
I'm really worried about
the top of the thing is the bananas.
Something
right?
must have happened to you when you were very young.
Well, I don't know. There's something going on there. But anyway, we won't talk about that. So John obviously spent some time in Mongolia. He's around the world all the time representing Komatsu Mining Germany with excavators. And he is spends a lot of time in the UK. So he is also known as the Warrington Santa Claus. Not to mention,
you know,
and we'll end this right now, he is... the Lincolnshire loafer. So, John, it's all yours. Okay.
And in the red corner, ladies and gentlemen, we have Tim the Banana Joseph, who is very modest about his achievements because he's actually the director of the mining school at the University of Alberta. And it's he who encouraged me to come along for 2 weeks a year and do some talking to the kids there. Tim weighs in at...
250-ish.
So, what we're going to do... Tim is a friend and a really good colleague, and I've learned a lot from him in the years that we've known each other. And why this came about... Why we're doing this and why this sort of presentation came about was when I started doing the lecturing, Tim, in order to vet the quality of what I was doing, used to come and sit with his students and watch me and heckle. Basically heckle. And the word bullshit figured large in the heckling. Normally, shielded by a cough and bullshit. So it put me off my stride completely because I'd look up and there he was in the middle of all these students. So as a riposte to this, I started visiting his lectures and did the same sort of thing. And the students love it.
You offered me a lot of coffee.
I did offer you a lot of coffee, yeah. The students loved it. And what the serious point of this, what actually happened was, we got a lot more information over to them in this sort of style than we did by sitting and just doing the traditional type lecture thing. And what we're going to do today, the write-up was done by Tim and it's complete bullshit, right? We're nothing like that. We're not going to do anything like that. Yeah, well, Tim takes an academic approach because he's an academic. I tend to take a more practical approach. We put together a presentation. We've only got 20 minutes, so we can't...
We've got less now. Keep going.
Yeah,
come on.
Well, yours was longer than mine. Laura?
We're not going there.
No, we're not going to go there.
No.
We've put together a presentation which hopefully takes a bit of an obtuse look at this subject of comparing hydraulics to cable. I'm a hydraulic excavator man, but I'd be the first person to say there is an application, obviously, for cable shovels, and in some areas we don't compete.
Oh, there's the wind!
Yes, well, you're okay. Go. History. Tim?
Yeah, well, if we look at the history, we really have only had hydraulic excavators since about 1958. Was that the first one?
1954 was the first.
1954,
the first all-electric.
Yeah, so we've got our all-electric or all-hydraulic excavator there. Both upper and lower works, all hydraulic.
That was the world's first excavator.
That was the first one. And we go by a little further. We've got a Marion steam shovel, which I don't know how good the lighting is in here. I don't know if we can drop these front lights a little bit. But essentially, I mean, that was one of the first styles of excavator we had on the Panama Canal going back to about 1893, right, when we first introduced them there. So that's where we've come from. And, of course, there's a long history with the rope shovel. And as it formed into the electric rope shovel, there's been a long history of this for many, many years. Whereas this is the new kid on the block. You know, a young whippersnapper just needs a good slap around the head once in a while. But I have to admit, from time to time, have put the rope shovel to shame. But not very often.
And we're taking over, of course.
Oh, well, we'll soon see about that. So we took some stats. And, John, you want to go through these?
These are just some of the stats that we sort of did a little bit of research before we did this. It's not totally off the top of our heads. So active shovels and excavators above 5 yards. Unfortunately, that's what the stats say. They don't tend to group them, but 1,700 rope shovels and 4,200 excavators working around the world today. I don't think that's too far out. There's probably a few less cable shovels, in fact. Mining Magazine, 2,500 industrial-scale mines. I mean, there's tens of thousands of mines in the world. If you look at China, there's 9,500 mines in China alone. But they're very small scale.
Well, mom-pop operations, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're talking
in fact, when we looked
scale.
At this, there was 250,000 mines actually recorded worldwide. Well, if you think 250,000, that means there is 225,000 which are basically artisanal miners. And that's just one guy and a basket, basically, and they're getting classified as mines. So 2,500 is what we said, okay, that seems reasonable what we might be putting machines into at greater than 5 yards.
Yeah. And then mine lives, believe it or not, the average gold mine life historically is 8 years. It's tiny, not all gold mines, but the average life is 8 years. Copper mine, 30 years. Life of mine, of course, is a key determinant in which excavator you're going to choose to do the mine. And we put this one up. This is just to show you the competition in the market in terms of bucket capacities. So hydraulic excavators tend to peak out at around 42 cubic meters. I mean, CAT have got one over at 52, but there's not so many of them. Cable shovels. When I started in the industry in 1980, there were cable shovels working right down here. We used to dig coal and shift coal with 22 RBs. Some of you in the remember those machines. 22 RBs, 30 RBs, 61, 71 RBs with cable shovels were what we dug in the face with. They've gone completely from the scene. Just go to the next
Steve, picture. Is one of these a pointer on here? The middle one? Oh, there we go.
There you go.
So if we look around here, we've really got a divide. So if we look around the 30, somewhere around the 30 to 34 yard, there's a huge number of products out there in that range. You go on the right-hand side of that, that's where we're starting to talk about where do we see the hydraulic versus the rope shovel. Where are we looking at that challenge being? There really is very little competition, and there's definitely in favor of the hydraulic excavator, and certainly we're seeing that with respect to the smaller class sizes right around the world, and that's the majority of those 2,500 mines. There aren't that many mines that are buying into the larger size.
No, and the next slide will demonstrate that, I think, fairly ably. Okay, so this is taken from Parker Bay statistics, so this is percentages. Okay, so if you look at these two curves, they add up to 100%. So 90 and 10 at the end here. So what we're saying here is that 90% of the excavators shipped in 2014, in 13 rather, at the moment, have been hydraulic, 10% cable. And as you can see, when you go back to here, where I was talking about 1980, when I came into the industry, the vast majority of machines were cable shovels. But they were the smaller end. Hydraulics have totally dominated that market now. There is no cable shovel, really, other than in some esoteric places and backwoods. I appreciate that manufacturers now...
You mean Warrington?
Sorry?
Lincolnshire.
Yeah, Lincolnshire.
Backwards Lincolnshire, yeah.
Where I happen to live, that's why.
3-yard machines.
We're not big on incest, unlike where you come from.
Oh,
anyway,
no, I'm not going to talk about that.
There aren't many small cable shovels now. I appreciate Russia and China are building some of the smaller ones in that market, but generally the market is totally dominated by hydraulic. And that's what we've tried to say here. So less than 38 cubic yard, really, hydraulic machines have the majority market. Bigger than 55 yard, cable shovel.
No question. There is no competition. I mean, the rope shovels dominate. Right, John?
Yep, and with CAT's decision to suspend the development work on the 9120, which would have been the world's biggest hydraulic excavator, that pretty well is where it sits today. In between, there's a little bit of competition. The shared market between 39 and 55 yard. So, what we decided to do was just pick out a few little areas that, in my presentations, when I'm making presentations, which I do frequently, comparing hydraulics to cable shovels, I would pick out as big advantages for hydraulics. This is the point of the lecture when Tim normally starts coughing and spluttering. And
I'm not coughing yet. We'll get to it.
Not yet, but you'll get there. This is the flexibility issue. The flexibility...
Ooh, support ooh. Assistant. We're ugh. About to lose power. No, updates will have been installed. Very interesting. Well, you see...
This is Schmiel.
The hydraulic excavator has completely vanished. This is fantastic. There's only one market.
Where is
it? It's a rope shovel. It's on the right-hand side. This is it. And well done, Daniel. We do appreciate that. So we'll talk about the rope shovel now. So on the left-hand side, we have a rope shovel. You can see how far he is set back from the face. This is just wonderful. He's set back so that if we do have some material issues, they're going to fall down. They're not going to interfere with the track system. So that positioning, that distance between the face and the active track system, there's a good considerable distance. And we know that. That's the reach associated with that unit.
Moot point. It's a completely moot point. It's only relevant when...
Safety is mute?
It's only
you're saying safety is mute?
It's only relevant when you're double side loading, and you're talking to the wrong slide, by the way. It's coming on in a minute, the one you were talking to. Right. The point we would make here was flexibility of dig. You have more material available to you without moving than you do with a cable shovel. You have the ability to dig at any height in the face up to the maximum parallel dig height with the cable shovel. We can dig face heights, various size machines, equivalent to any cable shovel. The only machine that can dig a higher face height than us is the 495, which digs a metre bigger than the PC8000, or the equivalent with other manufacturers.
Well, John, let's just talk about it a little bit. Because, you know, you've got an excavator here. You're stretching out, you're picking out a zone,
yep.
And you excavate, you go in, and you curl out,
yep,
right?
Absolutely.
You grab curl out. It's like getting your whole mouth around the apple and trying to get the whole thing in your mouth and biting down and taking the chunk out. And you know what happens? Your false teeth stay inside the apple. It comes
what
off.
What does that mean?
Well, you're just, we're nibbling at the face. Right? We do a nice sweep, gentle step up, there's less wear and tear on the object. I mean, we're going to have less impacts on the shovel.
Let's make the serious point. The point is, the cable shovel uses the crowd for positioning the bucket by and large in the face, and the hoist for the digging action.
I'll agree with that.
Right. So all the force at the bottom of the dig is going where? It's going up the hoist.
Well, there's no reaction at the bottom of the dig.
Right. What about if you get a bad blast?
Well, what happens with you if you get a bad blast?
Dig it.
And how are you going to dig it?
With the hydraulic crowd
and the amount of time it takes to do that and the effort required?
Absolutely, but at least we can do it. That's the point.
But your cycle time's got... The whole idea of using a rope shovel is we are looking for a good quality blast material to be able to...
Is it good so far? Is this working for you? Okay, move on.
Should we go to the next one?
I think we should.
I think we should, because we're going to run out of time here.
Okay, when I first started trying to sell hydraulic excavators into the oil sands in Canada... One of the great criticisms was that, well, because you stand closer to the face, which Tim alluded to earlier, we have a problem with the frozen oil cap that you'll be digging and this will fall down onto the front of the machine and damage the machine because you're much closer to the face. Well, of course, that's rubbish because with a hydraulic excavator, you have the capacity to take that frozen cap first before it starts to slip. With a cable shovel, you have only one digging action and it's a scooping action, and so you naturally produce an undercut, and that's why they were used to the top of the face falling down on them, because the cable shovel has to undercut.
But the cable shovel still does lift, so you'll get it to that particular point, you'll lift it further, you're trying to encourage it to fall down off the face as you swing out of the way. But again, this comes down to the space, John. Oh, you're falling over chairs now. So, you know, when we're looking at the hydraulic excavator, look at the proximity of the face. If you want to reach up there and grab that... And you don't have control, it's going to fall down right into your track system.
Right, but when it falls, you have the ability to push the bucket in front of you. You have, you have the ability to propel backwards at the same time. You don't have that capacity with a cable
shot. You don't need to.
You just sit and watch
out of the way already.
Fall on the front of the machine.
I'm not worried.
Okay, so we'll call that one a draw.
We'll call that one a draw?
Next.
Okay.
Now, here's another one. I'm really going to be interested to hear what you're going to come up with for this one. So, we have the ability to put a backhoe configuration on the machine.
Yeah, well, you know, Sam, we go back 50 years or so, we have backhoe configurations on rope shovels. But, you know, let's keep going. Let's see what's going with this. But who's going to piss about? Look at the size of his face. I mean, you know,
hold on a second.
I can move back with a dozer.
Hang on. Backhoe can dig any face a shovel can dig. Using a split bench method.
Oh, split bench method.
Fully recommended by Komatsu. Absolutely.
Recommended by Komatsu.
Very much so. Not by other manufacturers. Recommended by Komatsu. Sit on a 5-meter bench, chop the face down.
Okay, let's get the sales pitch out of here. No more sales pitch. Let's get going.
Benching. What about ramping down and ramping up? What about thin seams? What about interburden? How does a cable shovel cope with that?
Well, you know something with interburden? You would run on top of the interburden. But you know something? You wouldn't do that anyway because you would not put a rope shovel into that situation to start with.
It's the old you wouldn't do it argument.
Oh, why? This is a bulk moving machine. We've got a bulk moving machine.
It's like when you ask directions and somebody said, well, if I was you, I wouldn't be starting from here.
Now, hold on a second. Just because you were driving the other day and you got us lost because you didn't have to use the GPS.
Don't go there. Don't go there. That's another whole story.
I think we'd better move on.
Right. Next. Now this is the one you were referring to earlier. This is the closest to the truck.
Is that Paul Bertrand? Just a little closer here. Is that you, Paul? No, it's not Paul.
In all seriousness, this is a serious point, and this is a major criticism of hydraulic excavators. Just as an aside, normally when I make a presentation, somebody always asks me one question that I can't answer. And about a month ago, I was making a presentation, and they said, how tall is that man? And I've got absolutely no idea how tall he is, but I'm assuming he's not a midget, so I said 1.8 metres.
That's about fair.
5'10", 5'11". Yeah. So one of the criticisms levelled at hydraulic machines is that when you're double side loading particularly, it's difficult to spot the truck because the bucket is closer to the machine. You haven't got such a long reach. With a cable shovel, you can spot the truck in a much wider band and the excavator will still be able to load the truck.
Ooh.
Absolutely accept
that. Oh, thank you very much. I do appreciate that.
I accept that.
But
it's a completely moot point because within a year or so, there'll be technology that will spot the truck automatically, so it really won't matter.
Let's talk about track sizes. Just for a second. We're going to get into this in a second. Let's talk about track sizes. John,
but you're
gone.
I'm not
75-inch tracks. PC8000, 75-inch tracks. Okay? We can look at a 4100 or a 495. We've got 76-inch tracks, but we can go up to 138-inch tracks if we wanted to because we have the space to be able to do that. You start putting larger tracks in unsafe ground conditions.
Why would you want to?
Because you're going to sink.
Sink in rock?
Oh, yeah.
When did you not sink in rock?
No, not rock. What about soft ground conditions? So you don't have the ability to get that truck any closer.
You're
talking
about
larger tracks.
All sands I accept. You need wide flotation tracks. 99% of the mines we work in, ground conditions don't require high flotation tracks on shovels. In fact, you are on the other side, you tend to go for narrower pads because you want high ground bearing pressure so the excavator doesn't push back. A cable shovel can't push back because it can't develop a crowd action.
Doesn't need to push back. He's already spaced back from the face.
Absolutely spurious one. Don't listen to it, guys. It's wrong.
So,
here we go.
John hates this graph.
Tim's going to veer into academia now. I'll sit down and let him get on.
And you guys have probably seen this before. Those who've seen me present before, perhaps going back to Tucson in 2003. Was it Tucson 2003? I used this in Tucson 2003, and this was part of a presentation comparing for the oil sands the actual performance of hydraulic versus a rope shovel. And the difference is that you do have 138-inch tracks on the rope shovel versus 75-inch tracks on the hydraulic excavator. But the downside is that you can't float and you can't put larger tracks onto the hydraulic excavator because you can't get the truck in close enough. You start having impacts between the tires and the tracks. So you're basically living with pressures that are greater than the bearing capability of the ground underneath the tires, and so you're going to sink both the tracks of the shovel and the tires associated with the truck, and you get these two units leaning towards each other, falling over.
In oil sands, and it doesn't happen anywhere. This is just an academic... For the sake of academics.
Point taken. I had to show it, though, John, to irk you.
Fine.
I'm all about irking you.
Move on to your other academic-y ones now.
Oh, no, come on. This is not academic. This is real, okay?
Oh.
And my good friend Emerson will appreciate this, because here we've got, basically, a specific energy. So This is data we took from a PC8000, right?
Valid data.
This is data we took from a 4100. Basically, equivalent of capacity use. So we're looking at about 42, 43 cubic meters. In this particular instance here, we have a 76-ton payload associated with this machine, and with the 4100, we had 119 tons metric, okay, in this particular instance. The actual energy associated with this particular operation in the dig cycle was 14.7 megajoules. We had 23 megajoules here. But what's really interesting is when you put in specific energy, they're identical.
Score
so what does that tell you?
Hydraulic excavator.
No, but no, it doesn't. It's not. But what does it tell you? It's a draw.
Yeah.
Because essentially,
pretty logical.
If you think about it, the energy to dig a ton of material, it depends on how difficult it is in the face. This has actually nothing to do with machines at all. It's to do with the blast quality. It's to do with the actual geotechnical problems of the material. So all this talk that people keep going on about specific energy for machines, they're actually talking about the material in the face. So it's actually a moot point. Fair enough?
Yeah, I'd go with that.
Ooh, money.
Well, no, we're really going to have an argument over this one. This is kind of a crux thing.
This was difficult for us, actually.
We really nearly did come to blows over this one. There's several points I want to make, and these are serious points now. We're joking about it, but we're coming to some serious stuff. I mean, the key point of this presentation is not actually the data we're showing you. It's more about your attitude to the way that you assess things and the way that you make your decisions. One of the things that I think is really, really important, and this is what working with Tim at university and being challenged all the time has taught me, is that the preconceived notions we have are often wrong, and they're often there for the wrong reason. They're there because the guy you work for 10 years and respect terribly told you, and you've taken his opinions. They're there because you've seen a few things and have drawn conclusions. They're there because people like me tell you them. Right? They're not necessarily true. There's a combination of stuff.
They're not lies.
They're not lies.
We all twist the truth to our best benefit, or we say we actually enhance the truth, so we enhance the positives and we downplay the negatives, and we all do that.
That's what our job is.
Both sides of the fence.
Now we've tried here to get some comparative costs, and we've used Costmine, Infomine, which is a standard source which you can all get to, and it's got costs for different machines. In my humble opinion, they're bullshit. And I'll explain why in a minute.
And actually, I agree with John, because when we looked at the data, some of the costs that have been quoted for both hydraulics and for rope shovels, we couldn't believe it. We'd never seen numbers like that. It was impossible. We knew those numbers didn't exist. So we actually tried to put some reality to them. So we have taken Costmine's data, but we have hit it with a pan.
Well,
hard.
Well, hang on a minute. That's true to an extent. I don't accept these blue bars, which are far in excess of the red bars, for maintenance part. I don't accept that that's true, actually.
Well, the fuel one we did, right? Well,
the fuel one
we looked at, we said the fuel one was actually...
Absolutely.
Absolutely, that was fine. And the lube one was fine, and the wear parts was fine.
Yeah,
it's when
I
we got into the maintenance.
It's maintenance parts and maintenance labor. Effectively, they're saying it's double the maintenance labor to maintain a hydraulic shovel over a period of time than it is for a cable shovel.
And we think you guys probably have more information on this than we do. So this may be numbers we might be able to adjust and actually get a little bit more reality on by saying, okay, let's figure out, are those the costs that you guys see associated with maintenance and associated with labor associated with maintenance? So parts and labor, are those numbers that we could look at again?
We'll reissue it. Get that feedback.
Yeah.
But one of the classic reasons that I don't believe these is I know the difference between an electrically operated hydraulic shovel and a diesel-operated hydraulic shovel. Basically, the electric motor is a life of machine thing, more or less. You change the bearings at 35,000 hours. That's it. Diesel motors, you have to maintain, you have to service them, you have to do A services, B services, C services, D services. You have to change it at 14,000 hours or whatever. So I know that the labor associated with maintaining a hydraulic machine with a diesel motor is a lot more than with an electric. In the Infomine stats, it's exactly the same. And I know that that's wrong. And so that led me to believe that a lot of these are probably wrong.
So what we did is we put in the capital cost up front in today's dollars for an equivalent size 42, 43 meter cube unit. And then we projected the costs, added on to that, and we just did a straight line and said, okay, we're not going to buy any more hydraulic excavators. And it came out that we're looking at about 9.5 to 10 years for the life of the hydraulic excavator, which is about right.
Not for the life, but for the cost break even.
Yeah, for the actual change. So what we did then was we said, okay, let's purchase another one at that point and bring all the availabilities back to optimum availability and start again. And we still see the rope shovel doing this. But that effect is this here. If we actually soften that down and made it the same costs as the rope shovel, these two actually meet at year 25.
Now,
if you buy every 10 years.
I'm not arguing that the costs are the same. There are two points I want to make here. First of all, we're not presenting these as definitive costs.
No.
Don't
run
away with
that. It's an example from Cost Mindcare that we pull.
But one thing I do want to point out is that with the capital cost of the hydraulic shovel, you might look at a strategy which says I'm going to work this shovel for 60,000 hours and then change it. Work two shovels in the life that you would keep one cable shovel for. If you did that, you've still got the same capital cost as the cable shovel, but you've got the benefit, A, of new technology every 60,000 hours, and B, of the increased availability that a new machine will give you at 60,000 hours. And again, I'm not saying it's a good strategy, I'm just saying these are things you might like to consider that people haven't hitherto considered.
So just for interest, this was for a diesel versus a rope. We then took a... Well, John, why don't you explain this? We then said, what would happen... Go ahead.
No, carry on. You're doing well. You're doing my job. I like this.
Well, no, I don't want to do your job, because I used to do your job yourself. So basically, at year 25, after 25 years, with an overall change of 4% in availability, this would be for a soft rock mine, for a coal mine, we're looking at something in the order of being able to get an additional $25 million in terms of revenue over a 10-year period.
You can do it. I thought you'd struggle there.
No, so, I can do it.
This is my baby.
But you know what I'm saying? What it tells us is, if you do achieve that by having the additional availability, it means this line meets this line at that point. They drop down. They come together. So the build-up is a little bit different.
The point here is, as anybody, or on your own sites, on your own mines, do you ever calculate the cost of 1% availability on your shovel? Whether it be cable shovel or hydraulic, doesn't really matter. If you calculate that cost, it'll frighten you to death. This example that Tim's given here, 4%, 25 million, I was involved with a coal mine for quite a long time. We had two shovels working side by side. One was 4% more available than the other. Stripping ratio was 10 to 1. I won't go into all the details, but basically, that 4% meant that over the 10 years it worked, is it 2,400 hours more?
Yes.
And those 2,400 hours obviously yielded, I think it was 366,000 tons of coal extra. 366,000 tons of coal at whatever cost you want to put on it is an awful lot of millions of dollars. Now, when we bought those two machines, the one that was less available over the 10 years cost us $350,000 less. But the other machine earned us $24 million more. Now, the cost of 1% availability is staggering when you look at it. And that's why I think this strategy of perhaps replacing hydraulic machines more often, although for me, we've got lots of machines working well over 100,000 hours now and still keeping 85-90% availability. Replacing hydraulic machines more often for the same capital cost gives you tremendous availability benefits. And that means a lot of money. So I'm not giving you the numbers. The whole point of this jocular presentation was to try to get you to think a little bit differently about things, perhaps.
So just for fun, we took the hydraulic and we turned it into an electric hydraulic and we changed the numbers. So effectively what we did is we took the fuel out and we said it was the same power cost as for an electric rope shovel. And this is what happened. And literally these lines just start converging. So essentially, that fuel cost has a huge impact. So running a diesel hydraulic versus a hydraulic electric, there's a huge gain in terms of the power gains. You're only paying 7 cents a kilowatt hour for an electric, but you're paying a huge amount in terms of actual fuel costs overall. You start taking out the maintenance labor, and unfortunately, I have to admit, you start to see that blue line drop below the red line, and you start to see the gains on the hydraulic excavator.
I love it when he does that.
But that means you've got to get better control of what goes on in maintenance. So it's actually within the ballpark of the end user.
Hey, we've finished.
We are. So here we are. Conclusion.
So we've taken you through the development of the machines. I mean, bear in mind, cable shovels have been around since Noah, basically. They haven't changed substantially in design in those periods of time. And obviously, there's been introduction of AC and, you know, a load of technological differences within the machine. But the basic machine is the same. Hydraulics started from nowhere and have had to ramp up very, very quickly. The hydraulic machine that you saw in the picture there in 1952 or whatever it was is like what the mobile phone was like 20 years ago. You used to strap it in the car beside you instead of your wife. I mean, it was huge. Now you've got little...
But it was reliable, John. It was those phones, you could drop them. They would work forever. Your phone, you drop it, and it dies.
Do you want to do this one?
No, go ahead.
Thank you. It was huge. Now we've got iPhones, okay? And the technology with hydraulics are exactly the same. You know, early days, high-pressure hydraulics in a mining environment, not very good. Now, completely different. Long-held beliefs, that's what we've just talked about.
Absolutely.
Question everything.
I think, you know, the message here is that there is information out there that you really need to question. You need to look at this and say, okay, the sources we're getting our information that we're basing our decisions on, if we go to Costmine, where did Costmine get their data from? And remembering that anything you see that's published in terms of data streams, and Steve will help me out with this because he knows, you go to a data source, the data you see may be 2 years out of date by the time you get to it, because it took them 2 years to gather it and then 2 years to assemble it to put it into the database. So the fact we see these numbers, and then some of the things don't gel. Even Parker, you look at some of Parker's numbers, you look at them and think, how can that be? I know my costs are here. How come they're saying the actual standard costs across the globe are this number? Particularly if it's high and you're thinking, boy, I'm good. I'm doing really well. And you may be fooled into thinking you're actually okay, but things aren't quite as rosy as they might seem.
That's true. I know we're going to run over time a minute or two, but just there's a technique called zero-based budgeting. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's kind of accounting technique, but it's a really, really useful technique. Everybody under you will hate you for it, but honestly, it's a really good technique. Basically, what you say, normally when we do a budget, we add 5% to last year's budget, right? And sort of that's what we put in. Zero-based budgeting says you don't have a budget. You never had a budget. You've got no money allocated for anything. So whatever you want, you have to build a case for it and justify it for this year going forward. And it's a tremendous way to do things because you find you've got all sorts of stuff in there that you never use, that you don't need. And it becomes a really good technique. I would advocate applying the same techniques to all of these sort of things, all of the information that you're getting and digesting, zero-based budgeting. Assume you know nothing. Start from ground zero. Tim. Oh, God, we finished.
Thank you, brother.
He's got a banana. The bananas have nothing to do with me, people. I have to tell
John,
you.
John, thank you, brother.
Thank you.
It was good. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone.